Generals Sherman, Sheridan, and Sully had united in an appeal for the remission of the remaining weeks of Custer's sentence so that he might participate in the coming campaign. Sheridan's plans were well advanced, despite logistical problems delaying their execution. Old Fort Cobb, deep in Indian Territory, had been reactivated as an agency for the tribes that wanted to accept the reservations set aside in the Medicine Lodge treaties and remain at peace. During this time, Brevet Major General William B. Hazen was appointed military agent at Fort Cobb. All Indians not associated with Hazen's agency were regarded as hostile. Against these, Sheridan would make war. He organized three columns to converge on the area west of Fort Cobb, where the hostiles were thought to be laying out their winter camps. One would come east from Fort Bascom, New Mexico, one southeast from Fort Lyon, Colorado, and the third and largest south from Fort Dodge, Kansas. The reports from the different scouting parties were eminently satisfactory. Large bands of savages from the north had crossed the railroad and the Denver stage route going south. A body, supposed to be Sioux, was also reported crossing the Platte going north. The harassment to which they had yielded in the vicinity of their old hunting grounds along the Republican and its tributaries had so wholly disbanded their feelings of safety that the northern bands had almost entirely abandoned that section and were searching for new locations for their villages and families. The season was far advanced, and aside from their repeated disasters, their desire to be left alone was now gaining a bastion on the minds of the Southern Plains tribes. However, as the cold weather approached, Sheridan became more active in his preparations, and the time to strike came nearer. On October 4, 1868, Custer wrote from Fort Hays, Kansas, after having breakfast with General Sheridan and his staff, the following letter to his wife, Libby. The general said to me, "Custer, I rely upon you in everything and shall send you on this expedition without giving you any orders, leaving you to act entirely upon your judgment. The expedition will consist of 11 companies of cavalry, 4 of infantry, and 2 howitzers, accompanied by a large train." Wild West Podcast proudly presents Trails to the Ouachita, Part 3, Preparations for War. Three days later, Custer hurried down the trail to reassume command of his old regiment. But unfortunately, he had his hair cut short and a perfect menagerie of Scotch foxhounds. Custer arrived at Fort Dodge on October 7th. Fort Dodge was up the Arkansas River from Fort Larned and was of stone, like Larned and Riley. He proceeded the next day with a supply train of nearly 400 army wagons with its infantry escort from Fort Dodge. The rendezvous of the 7th Cavalry was on Mulberry Creek, about 30 miles southeast of Fort Dodge. General Custer paused here only to report to General Sully, commanding the district. The next day, he proceeded on, and in the afternoon sighted the familiar white army tents of the 7th Cavalry. The following reflects a rewritten fictional military account of Custer's arrival to retake his command of the 7th Cavalry, told from the perspective of a boy bugler named Ned Fletcher. It was a lovely crisp day on October 10, 1868. The white tents of the 7th Cavalry stood in orderly rows not far from the north bank of the Mulberry Creek in southern Kansas, about 30 miles southeast of Fort Dodge. Along the creek, patches of scarlet sumac stood out in occasional contrast to the yellow and gold background of the brushy timber, which had all been turned to fall colors by the early frost. The vast prairie was covered all around the camp with endless fields of tall, blue-stemmed grass waving in the wind. What a welcome there was as the troops turned out to receive him, and the dogs barked, and as soon as they might, the officers flocked to shake his hand. George A. Custer, who had risen to the rank of Major General during the Civil War, and was now serving as a lieutenant colonel in the regular army, sat down with his officers to an early evening meal in the officers' mess tent of the regiment. Having just been recalled to active service to lead the 7th in a winter campaign for General Philip Sheridan, after a suspension by a court-martial of some 9 months previous, he had arrived that afternoon and assumed command. There was tension in the air since several officers present had actively prepared the charges upon which the general had been convicted. However, Custer himself was determined to consider the incident closed, and to the fullest extent, to treat all of his officers solely based on their performance of duty. There were some new officers, and many new men, for recruits had been rushed to fill the ranks to war strength. However, there were enough friendly faces to make the camp of the 7th feel like home to me, and when we arrived, the celebration started until Major Sergeant Odell arrived. Odell immediately ordered us to dismount and stand at parade rest. I maintained the formal position assumed among the soldier ranks the best I could, and remained silent and motionless. This was when I noticed my left foot was not 12 inches to the left of my right foot, and with my weight resting unequally on both feet, I stumbled forward, causing my horse to pull backward on the reins. This motion got Odell's attention, and he enthusiastically approached me. "A new bugler, are you?" greeted Odell heartily. "Yes," I responded with a grin. "You ever been in the cavalry before?" Odell inquired. "No, sir. Just recently joined up, sir." "You must have all lost your skills when you joined up as a soldier, or just not learned them at all," Odell commanded. "Yes, sir," I replied. "I'll make them soldiering skills better over time." "Can you ride a horse?" Odell asked. "I mean, can you ride a horse well? Because, moreover, in battle on horseback, it's not the powerful but the skillful rider who will generally win the victory. The rider who does not know how to manage his horse will surely meet with disaster when he is matched against a rider who does know how to do so. No more forcible illustration of this truth can be found in the superior skill displayed by the mounted Indians of the West. They are the model irregular light cavalry of North America. Mounted, they are everything. Dismounted, they're nothing. Their remarkable skill in horsemanship is universally acknowledged. A cavalry recruit should only be assigned to a regiment once he promises to make a good rider and know how to care for a horse. Now what is it, son? Are you a good rider or not?" "Yes, sir," I replied. "I'm a good rider now, and I'll be better tomorrow and the next day." "Well, the general sticks to those he likes, and to those he doesn't like, the same. He's got a big heart. What's the news from Hayes? Is General Sheridan coming too?"
"Yes. He says the Indians are to be found and threshed."
"By golly, with Phil Sheridan and old Curly working together, this'll be no paper campaign, I reckon."
"Right you are," agreed Sergeant Walter Kennedy, who wore the chevrons of a sergeant major. "Because they turned Sully and the rest of us back into Dodge, the Mendians think they're the bosses. But when once Sheridan and Custer get after him in earnest, they'll change their minds." It was then that California Joe rode up in all his glory.
"Sheridan coming, young feller?" he asked. "Well, he can't do worse than them other high-up generals have done, but I sort of bet on Sheridan."
"Do you know him, Joe?" I asked respectfully.
"Do I know him, young feller? Know Sheridan? Well, bless my soul, I knowed Sheridan way up in Oregon more than 15 years ago, and he is only a second lieutenant of infantry, quartermaster of the foot, or something of that sort. I had a sneaking notion if they ever turned him loose, he'd hurt somebody. Say, weren't he old lightning in the war, I tell you?"
Joe wiped his hairy face with a piece of gunny sack that he used as a handkerchief.
"I'd just been appointed by General Custer, chief of scouts down here, but I told him I wouldn't serve. This here was to be a airy ambulance campaign. He said no. Him and Sheridan was going to chase the Indians horseback so as to catch him. That hit the nail square on the head. A column on wheels with the wagons piled full of soldiers, like as if they was going to a town funeral in the States. Stands about as many chances of catching Indians as a 6-mule team would do of catching a pack of coyotes. Why, that sort of thing is only fun for the Indians."
"
On the afternoon of October 18, 1868, Custer, now in command, had taken only one mouthful when his meal was interrupted by a succession of blaring war whoops, accompanied by rifle fire. All the officers surged outside, seized rifles, and joined the soldiers in returning the fire of a substantial body of warriors riding past the camp at full gallop. Then, after passing the entire length of the camp on one side, the red men swung around the end of the tent area and rode full speed down the other side of the camp. Riding in a single file, they exhibited great boldness and superb horsemanship. Upon completing the circle of the camp, they disappeared behind a low hill several hundred yards to the east. Within a few minutes, they appeared again, whooping and firing as they met another trajectory of the camp. Their maneuvers repeated several times with the apparent intention of enticing the soldiers to follow them. However, Custer had learned about Indian tactics in the campaign of 1867 and had no intention of being led into an ambush. The command during the attack was ordered to assemble for a defense. The troops took cover and began a conscious and compelling fire, which quickly depressed the warriors, and the episode concluded as abruptly as it had begun. The officers returned to their supper, and Custer asked for information on the attack's significance. "This sort of thing is almost a daily occurrence," said Lieutenant Moylan, the regimental adjutant, "and as a result, we have been placed in what amounts to a state of siege." Several detachments were sent out that night in a fruitless search for the hostiles' camp. Custer then broke camp and made a 17-mile scout to the east, but he failed to find the Indians' base of operations. On the evening of October 18, 1868, Custer wrote the following letter to his wife, Libby. "We have been on the warpath but 1 week. I joined the regiment near our camp a week ago, and within 2 hours, the Indians attacked the camp. We drove them away, killing 2 ponies. That night, I sent out 2 scouting parties of 100 men each to scour the country for 30 miles around." Custer finally abandoned the area south of the Arkansas River, which the red men regarded as their own, and established his camp on the north bank of the river about 12 miles below Fort Dodge. In the vicinity of other troops being concentrated by General Sheridan for a proposed winter campaign, he was free from harassment. On the evening of October 18, 1868, 12 miles from Fort Dodge, Captain Albert Barnetts wrote to his wife, Jenny, the following correspondence. "On last Saturday, a week ago, General Custer arrived with his hair cut short and a perfect menagerie of Scotch foxhounds, bringing H&M troops, Colonel Benteen and Lieutenant Hale and Cook, on the very evening of his arrival, sent out 3 columns in search of Indian encampments. He appeared to think that because his arrival here was immediately succeeded by an Indian attack on a small scale, which resulted in the untimely death of an Indian pony, and because we had considerable skirmish the day before with a party of about 75 Indians who had got after Captain Brewster while out riding alone, had run him into camp, and whom we subsequently chased for about 15 miles, that therefore Indians were plentiful hereabouts and could easily be found. But none of the columns found any Indians. So on last Monday, General Custer broke camp here and marched with the whole command for Medicine Lodge Creek, which we followed for a distance of 60 miles without finding any very recent traces of Indians, but found a lodge, a big medicine lodge, 60 feet in diameter and perhaps 40 feet high, containing 30 scalps and numerous trophies, which we brought away and burned the lodge. Also captured 4 ponies. We, then rather my troop and I, marched northward 30 miles to Rattlesnake Creek and for a distance of 30 miles along the stream, and then returned to the encampment of the regiment when the whole command returned to this camp, arriving here this afternoon. The Indians appeared here as we were leaving this camp for Medicine Lodge Creek and charged on our rear guard, which resulted in their having one of the ponies killed and the saddle and equipment, blankets, and a shield fell into our hands. The Indians also dropped 2 fine revolvers in their flight, one of which I got and one of my men got the other. General Custer's dogs caught and killed a wolf today, and we came into camp. On the evening of October 22, 1868, 12 miles from Fort Dodge, Custer wrote the following letter to his wife, Libby. We will probably remain here for 10 days before moving toward the Ouachita Mountains. Some officers think this may be like others before it, a campaign on paper. But I know General Sheridan too well to think that he will follow any such example. He does not readily relinquish an idea. The general has sent to the Osage Indians to employ them to our side. They will be a profitable assistance. During the latter part of October, while at Camp Sandy Forsyth, 12 miles below Fort Dodge on the south bank of the Arkansas River, Custer colored the horses. Here, Custer ordered the 7th Cavalry to assign similar colored horses to each company. As a result of this process, bays were assigned to B, F, H, and L companies, sorrels to C, I, and K companies, chestnuts to G company, browns to A company, blacks to D company, grays to E company, and mixed colors to M company. This decision caused dissatisfaction among the officers and enlisted men 2 weeks before the winter campaign. According to Benteen, this act at the beginning of a severe campaign was not only ridiculous, but was also criminal, unjust, and arbitrary in the extreme. Captain Barnett held a similar view and stated that the order was foolish. The following narrative, The Reminiscences of General Godfrey, then First Lieutenant, published in July 1927. On October 23rd, the 7th Cavalry went into a camp a short distance below Fort Dodge and named the camp Camp Sandy Forsyth in honor of Colonel George A. Forsyth, who with 50 volunteer scouts had withstood the attack of about 700 hostiles on the Arikari Fork of the Republican. The arrival of about 500 recruits and the same number of horses filled the organizations to the maximum. All the regiment's horses were then arranged according to color on one long picket line, and each troop commander, according to rank, was given a choice of color for their troop. According to color, there were 4 troops of bay horses, 3 sorrels, 1 each of black, brown, and gray, the band and trumpeters gray, and the 11th troop, odds and ends of all colors, including roans, piebalds, etc. For several years after this, I observed that these ratios obtained before requisitions for colors were given consideration in purchases. Drills and target practice were pushed to the limit. 40 of the best shots were selected for separate organization under the command of Lieutenant Cook. We youngsters named it the Corps d'Elite, and the name stuck throughout the campaign. On October 24, 1868, while Custer waited for orders to advance, he engaged in perfecting the training of his regiment, with intensive target practice as a meaningful exercise. Since it was announced that the 40 best shots would be assigned to an elite corps under the command of Lieutenant W.W. Cook, there was intense rivalry, and all of the men demonstrated substantial progress in marksmanship. Custer also arranged at a nearby village of friendly Osages to recruit a group of Indian scouts, consisting of Chief Little Beaver, a medicine man called Hard Rope, 11 warriors, and an interpreter. An old frontiersman, California Joe, and a dozen other white civilians completed his scout detachment. Joe was a rambling character who had trekked the entire West and has numerous hair-raising adventures, if his stories were to be believed. He had a heavy beard and long hair, and usually wore a vest, black slouch hat, a soldier's overcoat, and wool trousers tucked in the top of his knee boots. He was always seen with his stubby pipe and rode a finely assembled mule instead of a horse. In the following narrative from On the Plains with Custer, the author, Sabib, reflects a fictional account of what it was like to experience military training under the command of Custer's 7th Cavalry. Waiting for instructions from General Sheridan, the 7th Cavalry worked hard to arrive at what Sergeant Odell called their fighting weight. 500 fresh horses arrived by trail from Leavenworth. The general chose for himself a lively bay, which he named Dandy. The others were apportioned, and the troops, or companies, were colored. The horses were divided by colors, so one troop was composed of grays, another of blacks, bays, and so forth. The junior company commander must be content with the brindles, the mixed colors left over. Target practice was made an order of the day. For some, the recruits never had fired a gun. 40 of the best shots at all distances were formed into a company of sharpshooters under Lieutenant Queen's Own William Cook, with the long English side whiskers. There were scouting expeditions and plenty of hunting. The camp somewhat lived on wild turkey, deer, elk, buffalo, rabbit, and grouse. The general's dogs chased wolves and antelope. On October 24, 1868, 12 miles from Fort Dodge, Custer wrote the following letter to his wife, Libby. The general has finally decided upon a winter campaign. If we cannot find the Indians and inflict considerable injury upon them, we will be on the wing all winter. We are going to the heart of the Indian country, where white troops have never been before. The Indians have grown up in the belief that soldiers cannot and dare not follow them there. They are now convinced that all the tribes have been committing depredations on the plains this past season, have gone south, and are near each other in the vicinity of the Ouachita Mountains. They will doubtless combine against us when they find that we are about to advance into their country. Today, I gave the regimental saddler directions how to make me a large pair of saddlebags. They will contain nearly all that I desire to carry and can be put on my led horse. The men are at target practice, and it sounds like a battle. All the officers of the regiment are now learning signals. Books have been furnished us from Washington. I found all the line officers today in the classes. Most of the officers can now converse quite readily as far as they can see the signals. This is just the country for signaling, nature having formed admirable signal stations over this part of the territory. General Sheridan, in his letter yesterday, said furloughs would be given to every enlisted man who would do well. October wore away. Soon the Indians of the plains would be retiring to their villages for the winter. They would eat dried buffalo meat, and their horses would eat cottonwood bark and willows, and they would not expect to be interfered with. Then in the spring they would issue forth again to ride hither-thither, 3 miles to the cavalry's one. On October 28th, Albert Barnett writes to his wife Jenny at a camp near Fort Dodge. Day before yesterday, a party of Indians made a dash upon some animals lariated in the vicinity of Fort Dodge and succeeded in stampeding and driving off a few horses and ponies, besides doing some other damage, whereupon General Sully wrote a personal letter to General Custer telling him that they didn't feel safe at the post without some cavalry and requested that a troop be sent up to protect them. It is really amusing, isn't it? When you reflect that there are 7 companies of infantry here, armed with the finest guns in the world, and having in their possession, in addition to their ordinary arms, 3 or 4 pieces of artillery with men detailed to operate them. General Custer says that he is going to hold on to the letter to show if there is any dispute about it, i.e. that the cavalry was wanted here to protect the infantry. I was sent up yesterday with my troops to protect them, and here I am, encamped about 3/4 of a mile below the post. It has been arranged with General Sully that I am not to report to either the commanding officer of the post, Major Douglas, 3rd Infantry, nor to the commanding officer of the infantry camp near the post, Brevet Major Page, 3rd Infantry, but am to be entirely independent and use my own judgment in all cases. I expect to be stationed here until the expedition starts, and will accompany it in command of a squadron composed of G and L troops. L Troop, which is soon to arrive here from Puebla, is Colonel Sheridan's troop. By the reports of which Scout Buffalo Bill had brought up to Fort Hays from Fort Larned, the families of the Indians had been moving southward. Therefore, General Sheridan believed that the main winter villages would be found in the Indian Territory toward Texas. This was a wild, rugged country where white men rarely penetrated. But the Cheyennes, Kiowas, and the Comanches knew it well. On November 3, 1868, Custer wrote the following letter to his wife, Libby. You see, I have named our camp after the brave Sandy. I suppose that you have seen considerable excitement today over the presidential campaign. I do not presume that of the many hundreds of men here, a dozen remembered that today is election day. So little is the army interested in the event. I have been busy coloring the company horses. Don't imagine that I have been painting them. Still, I have been classifying all the horses of the regiment, so that instead of each company representing all the colors of the rainbow by their horses, now every company has one color. There are pure bays, browns, sorrels, grays, and blacks. I ordered Phil saddled this morning and rode up to the valley looking for a new camp. I was accompanied by my inseparable companions, the dogs, except Flirt, who's lame. About 3/4 of a mile from camp, I discovered a large wolf lying about 1/2 mile beyond. Calling the four dogs, Rover, the old foxhound, Fanny, the little foxhound, Blucher, and Maida, I started for the wolf. On November 7, 1868, Cheyenne Jack, an employee of Wilhelm Griffenstein, a widely respected trader among the Cheyenne, noticed a white woman at Yellow Bear's Arapaho camp while trading with the Indians. He gave this woman a pencil and paper to write a note he carried back to Fort Cobb. It was given to Dutch Bill on November 25th. The note read, "Kind friend, whoever you may be, I thank you for your kindness to my child and me. If only you could buy us from the Indians with ponies or anything, and let me come and stay with you until I could get word to my friends, they would pay you, and I would work and do all that I could for you. If it is not too far from the camp, and you are not afraid to come, I pray that you will try. If you can do nothing, write to W.T. Harrington, my father, in Ottawa, Franklin County, Kansas. Tell him we are with the Cheyenne, and they say when white men will make peace, we can go home. Tell him to write to the governor of Kansas about it, and for them to make peace. My name is Mrs. Clara Blinn, my little boy Willie Blinn. He is 2 years old. Do all you can for me." On November 12th, still waiting on the 19th Kansas Volunteer Cavalry, under the command of Colonel Samuel J. Crawford, the 7th Cavalry departed their position 12 miles southeast of Fort Dodge on the Arkansas River. They marched 5 miles to Mulberry Creek to join General Sully, the infantry, and the supply train. Earlier, General Sully and Uncle John Smith, an old trader who had married into the Cheyennes, had discovered a good rendezvous place for the expedition, where, forming the North Canadian River, Wolf Creek and Beaver Creek joined, about 100 miles south of Fort Dodge. Their destination before them was to establish a supply base known to history as Camp Supply. It was a cool day as the weather seeped through any thin cloth to drain the soul and fed the soul of those well-wrapped in warm layers of well-insulated fabrics. Then finally the air moved in, blossoming brilliant and arcing within the sun rays of a new day. So the sun shone on the prairie when the column lined up for departure. The cavalry was organized into a column of platoons, each platoon in line. The cavalry had often marched in this formation during the Civil War, when contact with the enemy was imminent, for it permitted quick deployment. The mounted band, who had white or gray horses, were near the head of the column, just to the rear of the commander and his staff. The band made a colorful display. The drummer, with his drums fastened either side of the pommel, twirled his batons and crossed them in striking the drums. And the trumpeters flourished their brass horns between the phrases of the music. It was like a circus parade, even including the Indian scouts in the procession. A dozen or more Osage warriors riding near Sully, all decked out in feathers and scarlet blankets. The wild animals were also present, running away from the column as it approached. Buffalo, antelope, deer, and minor game such as jackrabbits. They had a way of moving, strong, confident, with grace. The Indian scouts and some military personnel were permitted to orchestrate an occasional chase. Mingled with the band's music was the clank and rattle of trace chains and wagon bodies from Major Henry Inman's 300 wagons moving in columns abreast. The vehicles were loaded with rations, forage, and tools and materials to construct shelters for the supplies at the supply base. They were off on a march 100 miles to the south to find camp supply, and then to war. That's it for now. Remember to check out our Wild West podcast shows on iTunes or at wildwestpodcast.buzzsprout.com. You can also catch us on Facebook at facebook.com/wildwestpodcast or on our YouTube channel at Wild West Podcast, Mike King YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to our shows listed at the end of the description text of this podcast to receive notifications on all new episodes. Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you have any comments or want to add to our series, please write us at wildwestpodcast@gmail.com. We will share your thoughts as they apply to future episodes. Join us next time as we invite guest author and professor emeritus of philosophy, Jeff Broom, to discuss several of his books, including Indian Raids and Massacres, Essays on the Central Plains Indian War, Dog Soldier Justice, The Ordeal of Susanna Alderdice in the Kansas Indian War and Cheyenne War, Indian Raids on the Road to Denver, 1864 to 1869.